So, imagine you live in this really quiet, well-maintained apartment building.
Oh, right. Like the kind with the shared garden and everything.
Yeah, exactly. You've got a shared garden, maybe friendly group chat where people offer up spare moving boxes and just, I mean, generally a good sense of community.
Sounds ideal, honestly.
Right. So you head down to the lobby to check your mail, expecting, I don't know, a utility bill or maybe a package delivery notice. But instead, you pull out this dense, highly technical legal summons.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that ruins your day.
Completely. And the real kicker here is that this isn't a new or unexpected problem. It is literally from your neighbor for the third consecutive year
Jeez.
over the exact same grievance that you thought the community had, settled months ago.
Yeah, I mean, that scenario captures a very specific, just grinding kind of exhaustion.
Oh,
For
absolutely.
the people who are trapped in that cycle, it's this chronic administrative headache that just bleeds time, emotional energy, and obviously financial resources.
Yeah, it totally shifts the experience of homeownership, right? Like from comfort to constant legal defense. It
Exactly.
honestly feels incredibly reminiscent of the movie Groundhog Day.
Right.
But, instead of waking up to Sonny and Cher playing on the radio, these strata owners are just waking up to a fresh stack of tribunal summonses.
Right, yeah. Every single year, forced to fight a battle that was supposedly already resolved.
So today, our deep dive focuses on a really fascinating legal document from 2026. This comes out of the Western Australia State Administrative Tribunal.
Which is often abbreviated as WASAT, just for context.
Right, WASAT. And it's a decision authored by Deputy President Judge H. Jackson.
Yeah, and this decision, it honestly serves as a pretty comprehensive masterclass in administrative law.
It really does. So for our mission today, we are examining a ruling centered on a frequent litigant named Dr. Eliana Sage and her Mount Lawley Strata Company. We want to unpack how the legal system calibrates this really delicate scale, balancing a citizen's fundamental right to access justice against a community's right to live without being basically buried under an avalanche of repetitive paperwork.
Right, oppressive litigation. And to really understand that balance, you have to look at the actual machinery of the tribunal itself.
Yeah, let's get into that.
So Dr. Sage is classified in the documents as a frequent applicant. She has initiated multiple legal actions under the Strata Titles Act of 1985 against her strata management company.
And occasionally against the individual lot owners in her building, too, right?
Exactly. So we are dealing with someone who is highly active in the legal system, just constantly bringing her property managers and neighbors to court.
And this high volume of litigation, it sort of reached a critical threshold in 2025.
Yes, it did. During a previous proceeding, another tribunal member, Member Cade, invoked Section 47 of the State Administrative Tribunal Act against Dr. Sage's filings.
Okay, so Section 47, break that down for us.
So Section 47 operates as this necessary systemic filter. It grants the tribunal the authority to strike out or dismiss proceedings if they determine the filing is frivolous, vexatious, misconceived, or, lacking in substance.
Basically, just an abusive process.
Exactly. And Member Cade utilized this mechanism to strike out several of Dr. Sage's proposed orders because he found the sheer repetition of previously settled claims to be fundamentally oppressive to the respondents.
Okay, so if I'm tracking the logic of the SCT Act correctly, getting struck out under Section 47 doesn't just mean that one specific case goes in the trash.
Right.
It triggers a secondary mechanism, which is Section 49, and that acts as a barrier to reentry.
That is exactly right. Essentially, if your case is dismissed for being an abusive process, you are placed in this legal holding pattern.
You can't just like draft a new application for the same issue, change a couple of words, and drop it in the mail.
No, you are completely locked out of the system until a judicial member explicitly grants you leave.
Which is formal permission.
Right, formal permission to commence any new proceedings regarding that exact same matter.
And that is the core procedural hurdle that Dr. Sage is facing in this 2026 document. She's basically standing at that barrier, asking Judge Jackson for leave to initiate a whole new set of proceedings against the Strata Company.
But to truly grasp why this strict barrier exists, we have to contrast how a tribunal operates compared to, say, a traditional Supreme Court.
Okay, how so?
Well, tribunals were designed to democratize justice, so they are generally much less formal, they move faster, and crucially, they operate as a no-cost jurisdiction.
Oh, wait. Which creates a pretty unique vulnerability in the system, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Because in a standard civil court, if I sue my neighbor frivolously and I lose, the judge can order me to pay my neighbor's expensive legal fees.
Right, which is a huge deterrent.
Exactly. Yeah. That financial risk stops people from filing baseless claims just to be annoying. But in a no-cost jurisdiction, the respondent, so in this case, the strata company and the owners, they have to absorb that financial shock every single time.
Yeah, even if they win the case handily, they still pay. And the financial and emotional attrition in that environment is staggering.
I can imagine. Especially since the strata company operates on fees paid by all the owners anyway.
Exactly. While the Strata Titles Act does allow for costs to be awarded in very rare extreme circumstances, a respondent is almost never fully compensated for the thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours lost to endless litigation.
So because that traditional financial deterrent is just absent, the tribunal itself kind of has to become the active gatekeeper.
That's the key. Sections 27 and 49 are these structural reinforcements. They prevent a specialized, highly accessible court system from basically being weaponized against the public.
You know, that framing totally changes how I view Section 49. It isn't just some bureaucratic penalty. It's actually a vital protective measure for the community.
Right.
But let me push back for a second. If we assume for a moment that a property manager actually is acting maliciously, there seems to be a massive risk here. Couldn't Section 49 essentially muzzle a legitimate grievance?
How do you mean?
Well, could the tribunal theoretically lock out a valid, urgent complaint just because the applicant has a history of being, you know, persistent or difficult?
Ah, I see. Well, the legal architecture actually anticipates that exact danger. Judge Jackson doesn't simply deny Dr. Sajay's request based on her reputation as a frequent applicant.
Okay, so what do they base it on?
The decision relies heavily on a really vital precedent, which is the 2022 Spiro case, authored by former President Pritchard.
Oh, right. The interests of justice test.
Exactly. The interests of justice test. A judicial member reviewing a request for leave has to conduct this rigorous dual-layered analysis to ensure they aren't, you know, silencing a valid alarm.
So what's the first layer?
First, they evaluate the construction of the new case.
Mm-hmm.
Are the parties identical to the last lawsuit? Are the core arguments the same? Is the applicant asking for the exact same relief?
It basically boils down to a strict no reruns policy.
Yeah, precisely. If the new application is structurally just a carbon copy of the old one, it automatically fails that first layer.
And the second layer?
The second layer requires examining the context of the previous dismissal. The judge has to look really closely at why the applicant was struck out the last time.
So if a case was dismissed on just, like, a technical filing error.
Right, or because the applicant genuinely wasn't given a fair opportunity to present their evidence, then the interests of justice heavily favor letting them back in.
That makes sense.
But if, as Member Cade determined back in 2025, the previous case was struck out because the applicant was litigating in a way that actively harassed or disadvantaged the other party, well, then the scales tip in the opposite direction.
Right, the logic of that test holds up perfectly on paper. But as I was reviewing the primary sources for this deep dive, I noticed this rather glaring textual contradiction that Dr. Sajay's application really tries to exploit.
Oh, the phrasing of Section 49.
Yes. Section 49 explicitly states that the barrier to reentry applies when a proceeding is dismissed under Section 47.
Right. The language strongly implies the entirety of the lawsuit.
Exactly. Yet, back in 2025, Member K didn't dismiss Dr. Sajay's entire proceeding. He only struck out specific parts of her cases, which were logged as CC-435 and CC-736.
Mm-hmm.
So the remaining portions of those disputes are, like, technically still active on the tribunal's docket.
And this exposes one of the most complex battlegrounds in administrative law, which is statutory interpretation.
Yeah.
When the literal text of a law creates a logical fracture, judges have to decide whether to read the statute literally, based on the exact words on the page, or purposively, based on what the legislature was actually trying to achieve.
And on a strictly literal reading, Dr. Sajay actually has a very compelling argument here.
She really does.
If Section 49 only triggers upon the dismissal of a complete proceeding, and she only had fractions of her cases struck out, she basically shouldn't need to ask for leave at all.
Right.
It's kind of akin to a restaurant having a strict policy that says, you know, patrons may not bring a whole outside pizza into the dining room.
Ah, right.
A pure literalist would argue that bringing in three separate slices doesn't technically violate the rule, even though it completely undermines the obvious purpose of the policy.
That's a great analogy. And if the tribunal adheres to a hyper-literal interpretation of a proceeding, they effectively strip themselves of that gatekeeping power we just established was necessary.
It would be a disaster for them.
A strict literal interpretation in this context would effectively dismantle the tribunal's ability to function. So Judge Jackson addresses this contradiction by drawing on the 2009 Laurent and Commissioner of Police case.
Right.
In that precedent, the deputy president ruled that the power to dismiss a proceeding under Section 47 must inherently include the power to strike out just a part of a proceeding, regardless of the missing words.
Which is a pretty bold stance, especially considering that other areas of the SAT Act, like Section 50, explicitly use the phrase part of a proceeding, while Section 47 conspicuously leaves those words out.
Yeah, it's a clear omission.
The judge is basically acknowledging the clear inconsistency in the legislative drafting. But she's choosing to bridge the gap judicially to maintain the system's integrity.
Because the alternative is just catastrophic for the daily administration of justice. Think about the mechanics of a loophole like that.
Okay.
A vexatious litigant could gather 9 previously rejected frivolous claims and bundle them with one single newly fabricated grievance.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Because that one new claim prevents the judge from striking out the entire proceeding, the applicant escapes the Section 49 barrier indefinitely.
Wow. So they could endlessly recycle oppressive claims by simply attaching a marginal new complaint each time.
Exactly. Forcing respondents to litigate the same 9 bogus claims in perpetuity.
That's wild. And the judge anchors her reasoning in the foundational objectives of the SAT Act itself, right? Specifically sections 32 and 9.
She does. Those sections mandate that the tribunal has to operate according to equity, good conscience, and the substantial merits of the case.
While simultaneously minimizing costs to all the parties involved.
Right. So allowing a linguistic technicality to facilitate endless financially ruinous litigation would directly violate the tribunal's core mandate.
This is exactly why purposive interpretation is so crucial in administrative settings. The law isn't just a collection of grammar rules to be debated, right?
You're really not. It is an active mechanism meant to achieve a specific functional outcome.
So by closing that loophole, Judge Jackson affirms that Section 49 does indeed apply to Dr. Sage. She requires leave.
Which forces the tribunal to meticulously analyze the actual substantive contents of her 2026 application to see if it passes that interests of justice test.
And the substance of her new application is really where the behavioral patterns become undeniable.
Let's look at what she actually filed.
Yeah, so Dr. Sage outlines 3 primary orders in her filing. Orders 1 and 2 target Southern Strata Services, the management company.
Mm.
She is asking the tribunal to declare the last 3 years of contracts between the Strata Company and SSS, so spanning 2023 to 2026, as fundamentally invalid.
And consequently, Order 2 demands the immediate termination of the current contract.
Right. And then Order 3 escalates the demands significantly. She requires SSS, along with a specifically named individual, Zoe Maxwell, to return all funds allegedly unlawfully charged to the Strata Company.
She also couples this with a demand for the comprehensive, immediate disclosure of all financial records, ledgers, and accounts.
The justification she provides for these sweeping demands reads like a systemic collapse of the property's governance.
It sounds incredibly serious on its face.
Right. She alleges major breaches of the Strata Titles Act. She claims there is active fraud occurring under the criminal code, points to major violations regarding the goods and services tax, and asserts that recent annual general meetings were conducted illegally.
Evaluated in isolation, these are severe allegations. Systemic fraud, tax evasion, illegal corporate governance, these are not trivial matters in Strata managed.
Definitely not. They would normally command immediate judicial scrutiny.
However, Judge Jackson applies that no reruns principle by cross-referencing these 2026 claims against Dr. Sage's extensive filing history within the tribunal.
And the historical comparison reveals a staggering lack of originality.
Yes, it really does.
In CC 435 of 2024, Dr. Sage sought the termination of the management contract because it repeatedly contravenes the act. In CC 99 of 2024, she demanded immediate termination of the SSS contract.
And going back even further to CC 787 of 2022, she requested termination citing breaches of the act and illegal conduct.
It is highly reminiscent of a student who, like, receives a failing grade on a term paper. changes the font, updates the cover page to a new year, and just submits the exact same essay to a different professor.
Hoping the new grading rubric works in their favor.
Exactly. It's a new cover page, but the exact same essay.
That analogy perfectly highlights the diplomechanical nature of her filings. When Judge Jackson compares the text of Order 3 in this new application to the demands made in CC 99 of 2024, the similarity is undeniable.
Yeah. Aside from inserting Zoe Maxwell's name and making some marginal cosmetic drafting adjustments, she's submitting identical demands.
Identical demands for the return of funds and financial disclosures, based on the exact same GST and fraud allegations that have already been processed.
Okay, but a critical listener might point out an obvious tension here. Even if she is repeating herself verbatim, the allegations of GST fraud and unlawful fees remain incredibly serious.
Oh, absolutely.
If the strata manager actually is mismanaging tax funds, it seems counterintuitive that the tribunal would just refuse to investigate those merits, regardless of how many times the applicant brings it up.
And that distinction is actually the linchpin of Judge Jackson's ruling. It illustrates a fundamental concept in civil law.
Okay, what is it?
The tribunal in this 2026 decision is making absolutely no determination on whether the GST was filed correctly or whether the AGMs adhered to protocol.
They aren't looking at the facts of the GST at all.
No. The actual merits of the strata management contract are irrelevant to this specific procedural judgment. What is highly relevant is that Dr. Serge already had a comprehensive final hearing on these precise issues in CC 99 of 2024.
She was not silenced or ignored by the system.
Not at all. She had the floor. She presented her evidence regarding the GST, the fees, and the alleged illegal conduct.
And the tribunal weighed that evidence, conducted a full hearing, and ultimately made legally binding orders dismissing her case based on the facts presented.
Exactly. Now, when a citizen receives a judgment they believe is factually or legally flawed, the justice system provides a highly structured, specific remedy.
The appellate process.
Right. If Dr. Serge sincerely believed the tribunal erred in its assessment of the GST fraud in 2024, her recourse was to appeal that specific decision to a higher authority.
Which, in this jurisdiction, would be the Supreme Court of Western Australia.
Yes. The architecture of the legal system is vertical. You move up the judicial hierarchy to challenge a ruling you believe is unjust.
You do not move laterally.
Exactly. You cannot lose a final hearing, walk out of the courtroom, and simply draft a new initial application to the exact same tribunal, hoping a different judge will interpret your evidence favorably.
And this lateral maneuvering is exactly what Member Kate identified as an abusive process in 2025.
Right. By bypassing the Supreme Court and endlessly refiling at the base tribunal level, Dr. Sarge forces the strata company to continually redirect community funds away from building maintenance to defend against legally settled claims.
So the result of this whole analysis is a definitive rejection. Judge Jackson formally refuses to grant Dr. Sarge leave to commence the 2026 proceedings.
The application is denied and the Section 49 barrier remains firmly intact.
But the architecture of Judge Jackson's written decision contains this remarkable, almost sassy, preemptive safeguard at the very end.
Oh, paragraph 70 and 71.
Yes. They basically operate as an impenetrable legal failsafe. Judge Jackson spends the entire document establishing why the Section 49 loophole must be closed through purposive interpretation and why she has the authority to deny leave. But then she adds this brilliant provision. She states that even if a higher appellate court were to review this and determine that her interpretation of the loophole is wrong.
Like, even if the Supreme Court rules that Section 49 only applies to whole proceedings, meaning Dr. Serge never needed her permission in the first place.
Exactly. Judge Jackson asserts that she would simply invoke Section 47 independently to strike out the new proceeding immediately anyway, relying on the exact same evidence of vexatious repetition.
It is a dual-layered defense of the tribunal's integrity. It ensures that regardless of how a future court parses the statutory loophole regarding the word proceeding, this specific cycle of oppressive litigation is terminated at the source.
It is very easy to view this entire situation as just a localized bureaucratic spat confined to a single apartment building.
But it's much bigger than that.
Right. Zooming out, this ruling signals a massive defense of a foundational legal concept, which is the principle of finality in litigation.
Yes. Because if the justice system cannot guarantee that a final decision is actually final, the fundamental authority of the court dissolves.
The concept of finality is what separates a functioning, orderly legal system from perpetual societal conflict.
Precisely. If a tribunal rules that a contract is valid, but the losing party can legally force the community to relitigate that validity every 6 months, the initial ruling is nothing more than a temporary suggestion.
And Judge Jackson classifies this continuous behavior as a collateral attack on the tribunal's own past decisions.
Which is spot on. Entertaining these repetitive claims doesn't just financially harm the respondents, it actively degrades public confidence in the administration of justice.
Because if citizens observe that court orders carry no permanent weight, the entire structure loses its legitimacy.
The logic of finality is undeniable, particularly when it comes to protecting everyday residents from financial and emotional exhaustion.
Yet this entire framework of classifying individuals as frequent applicants and requiring them to seek judicial permission just to file basic paperwork, it introduces a pretty profound systemic risk.
It does.
The mechanisms sections 47 and 49 provide are necessary shields, but judicial labels are incredibly difficult to shed once they're applied.
That's a really important point to leave you with. Once an applicant is formally documented as vexatious or an abuser of process, the lens through which the legal system views them is permanently altered.
Their credibility is inherently compromised before they even present a single shred of new evidence.
Exactly. And it forces us to consider a disturbing but entirely plausible hypothetical. What if, say, several years from now, a completely different property management company takes over that exact building and engages in highly sophisticated, verifiable fraud?
It creates a scenario where the boy who cried wolf is basically institutionalized.
Right.
If Dr. Saj uncovers legitimate, well-documented criminal behavior in the future, her history of repetitive, unfounded filings becomes a massive liability for the entire community.
The legal system is so heavily insulated against her past behavior that it might automatically discard a genuine warning sign.
In the pursuit of protecting systemic efficiency and shielding innocent citizens from harassment, the legal framework risks engineering a permanent blind spot to the exact injustices it was designed to adjudicate.
It really underscores the sheer weight of judicial gatekeeping. The line between protecting a community from an avalanche of oppressive paperwork and deafening the legal system to a valid, urgent alarm is perilously thin.
Yeah. Every time a judge closes a door to prevent an abusive process, they really have to ensure they aren't inadvertently locking out the truth.
Exactly.
It is a sobering reality regarding how justice actually functions outside of pure theory. The mechanisms that protect communities from endless legal warfare can also lock the door on future accountability.
It's definitely something to keep in mind.
Yeah, think about that the next time you navigate a frustrating bureaucratic hurdle or, you know, simply walk down to your lobby to check your mail. Thanks for joining this deep dive.